You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, presented by Trainer Road, cycling's most effective training tool.
I want to be the title sponsor. What's it going to cost?
I think around 10 million.
Yeah, I that's a bit out of my budget.
I have the impression that we are in the place where we have to be now.
Greg had a really bad back all last week, so we caught up on your podcast with me giving him a back massage and him listening to you guys.
That's a wonderful image.
With exclusive interviews and the best analysis on two wheels, this is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Good evening, Richard. Hello, Richard.
Just the two of us, Lionel.
Yeah, it's the team basically falling apart, isn't it?
I wouldn't go that far. Daniel's going to join us for this podcast. We're going to speak to Daniel a little bit later on for his insights into the 2016 Tour de France route, which we'll be talking about. But we'll also be talking about something else while we're here, Lionel. And that leads me to a familiar question. Where are we, Lionel?
We're sitting on a bench outside the London Velodrome. Night is falling. It's night three of the London 6 Day. They're projecting a logo onto the side of the Pringle there. Looks quite attractive. We've been into the Velodrome. Atmosphere's building. The under-23s are racing as I talk. And a little bit later on, we'll be capturing some of the sounds and atmosphere of the rebirth of the London 6.
And speaking to some people, it's an odd bench that we're on, isn't it? Your feet only just reach the ground.
Yeah, I'm not necessarily short, but it's not designed for anyone under 6 foot three, is it, this bench?
It isn't, Lionel. So listen, let's crack immediately on, because we want to go into the Velodrome and we're going to hopefully do some interviews with people who are riding or supporting the riders of the 6 day race. So the Tour de France route was announced earlier today, 2016. We've usually gone over to that. We didn't go this year, did we? Why was that?
I think because this is on. I think it was just too much. We couldn't quite get it to dovetail. And with Daniel being in Berlin, we're spread a little bit thin, aren't we? You know, we're trying to cover all the bases. And we thought, come to the London 6 Day. The Tour de France unveil has, in my opinion, been spoiled in recent years by it all being leaked on the internet in the weeks leading up to it. This year, the predictions of the route were somewhat awry, particularly the final week in the Alps. The tour organisers managed to hold back quite a few of the significant details. So some of the route was quite a surprise. I generally steer clear of seeing what the rumours are, but I think we all knew Mont Ventoux was going to make a return. And I think we knew that there was going to be an uphill time trial somewhere.
I thought we didn't go because it's usually a bit of a waste of time. And it involves an overnight stay in Paris because it starts so early in the morning. So that's always inconvenient. But anyway, we'll save our resources for going and covering actual races, I think, Lionel. A kindred spirit for you, Vincent Lavenu, the general manager at AG2R. They put out a press release after the route was announced. Lavenu said, "I hate rumours. Therefore, I did not check social medias before the official presentation." A man after your own heart there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well done, Vincent.
So it starts up in Mont-Saint-Michel, where we were in 2013. There was a time trial there that was won by Chris Froome, was it? Or no, he was second to Tony Martin. Tony Martin won the stage, but Froome really laid the foundations for his overall victory in 2013.
Yeah, I had some... Well, I think we both... Did we both have Moule? We recorded a podcast over an early dinner in a nice restaurant with big glass windows giving you a great... backdrop of Mont-Saint-Michel. Stunning part of the world, beautiful place for the Grand Depart, and it's because it ties in with commemorating the D-Day landings as well, with the finish up at Utah Beach. It's going to be quite a poignant day, I think, the first day.
Yeah, as you say, stunning backdrop. You bring up food very early there, Lionel, because obviously Daniel's going to be giving us insight into some of the climbs, a lot of new mountains and new climbs in next year's tour. But you can give us an insight into the culinary tour of France, because I know that's the first thing that you think about when you see the route. You sort of plan your dinners. Any particular highlights next year?
Well, what have we got? We've got, there's lots of highlights. Into Normandy, at stage in Normandy, so there'll be...
Cider and mugs.
There'll be cider and brandy in Normandy. We go through the massive Central, the Cantal region, and some fabulous cheeses there. Should be a good tour for Cassoulet, with a finish in Revel this year. But really, it's all about the Alps and rich, cheesy dinners for nearly a week, I think. It's going to be raclette, and it's going to be tartiflette, and it's going to be melted cheese and boiled potatoes and cornichons and cured hams. It's going to be a heavy old week. And then the final stage starts at Chantilly, the famous chateau at Chantilly, and also the birthplace of whipped cream, squirty cream. So particularly looking forward to that.
That's not really a highlight as far as I'm concerned. I think we're getting some Bourgogne breast chicken as well.
Yeah, the Bourgogne breast chicken, it's a start there, but we'll have to try and get a hotel nearby so we can go to the best chicken restaurant in Bourgogne breast, which
in the world.
In the world, the best French chicken Bourgogne breast restaurant. We ate there a couple of years ago, I think, with the guys from Velo News.
We did. How about the cycling, Lionel? Oh. What's going to happen? I mean, there's an early tricky stage. That first stage is obviously a sprinter stage. Another opportunity for a sprinter to take the yellow jersey. Mark Cavendish has never quite done that. He will be hoping against hope that he can finally take his first yellow jersey. We'll see. But stage two, a nasty little climb up the finish, isn't it? That might suit Peter Sagan, but expect to see some of the overall contenders showing there as well, I think.
Yeah, the first 5 days, really, there's three for the sprinters. The first day, Angers and Limoges will probably fall to the sprinters. And then there's two of these cheeky stages that will bring the climbers out. The one to Cherbourg, or near to Cherbourg, featured, I think, a 3 kilometre long climb at the finish. And stage five takes them into some pretty difficult climbs in the massive Centrale, and I think the Pas de Payroll is on the agenda that day, and they are always really sticky roads. If it's hot, it's really racing country, and I think we don't have a real high mountain. We don't have the sort of the five-star famous mountains on the agenda, save perhaps the Tourmalet de Juplin. But it's a kind of racer's tour, and those two stages in the first week, stage two to Cherbourg and stage three to Lyon, they will make the overall contenders have to pay attention to each other. And sets it up before we get to the Pyrenees, and that's really Daniel's terrain, isn't it? Talking about the mountains, we'll hear from him in a little bit.
Yeah, fewer mountain top finishes, but more mountains, and that, you know, more opportunities for interesting racing, perhaps. A lot of sort of tricky little descents before finishes as well. Some nice short stages as well, which often produce exciting racing. There's really, it's unpredictable in a sense, and there's a lot to look forward to. The one stage that, you know, you imagine you have a pretty good idea how it will unfold is the stage of finish in Mont Ventoux on Bastille Day, way up from Montpellier, where there's a stage of finishes in Montpellier as well, isn't there? Could go through the Camargue. We don't know the route in real detail yet, but possibility of crosswinds down there. I think possibility of crosswinds first couple of days as well, first day in particular. But that stage, Montpellier up to Mont Ventoux, will be one that Chris Froome will fancy. His definitive, decisive mountain stages in the two tours that he's won have been Mont Ventoux in 2013, Aix-Trois-Domaine as well, but Mont Ventoux and La Pierre-Saint-Martin in 2015. Both of them have involved sort of long, flattish run-ins before a big climb up to the finish, and these are the sorts of mountain stages that do suit him, and I think that's the one that he will be eyeing. In fact, I think he did tell British Eurosport when he was interviewed that was a stage he had his eye on.
I think we've talked in the podcast in recent months about our sort of fantasy Tour de France route being one without lots and lots of big mountain finishes, because they tend to set the pattern for the race and then that pattern is repeated. And we kind of fantasised about a tour of Moyenne Montagne, and this isn't that, but it's pretty much as close as Christian Prudhomme and his team can go to that. The summit finishes, Arcalis in Andorra, that I think was first used in 97 when Jan Ullrich won. You know, that is that's one opportunity for Chris Froome to lay down the gauntlet. Mont Ventoux is the other. And then if nobody has got themselves into a sort of commanding position, it then all becomes about those two tricky time trials, one of which, the 37 kilometre one on stage 13, so after the Mont Ventoux stage, that's really hard. That's in the Ardèche, and that will be a day that could really sort of catch people out. But again, if it's a hot day, I mean, we're speculating, aren't we? It's not.
Oh, you don't like the speculation. It's potentially a very, very tough stage, that very beautiful stage to watch as well, I would think. Mont Ventoux, going back to that Basile day, it was a Basile day in 2013 as well when Chris Froome won up there, so that's interesting. But the time trial's obviously back this year. There was it was a time trial light tour in 2015, but there are two, and I think one of them was a bit of a surprise, the 17-kilometre mountain time trial, which, you know, again, similar to the stage that we saw in 2013, perhaps, shortish, and will suit a climber-type rider, someone who can time trial and climb, such as Chris Froome and Nairo Quintana, or Alberto Contador, really. I mean, it suit any of those guys. The 37-kilometre one is a bit more difficult to speculate. Not that you want to speculate, but...
No, but it's not sort of 50 kilometres or 55 kilometres.
It's not classic Tony Martin, Fabian Cancellara style time trial at all.
No, from looking at the profile and just looking at the roads, quite a stiff climb at the beginning and another one at the end. So it's one where, you know, there's going to be, you know, the risk and reward comes into it, and pacing and all of that kind of thing. And it will be one that rewards the rider who, you know, basically is able to judge their effort.
Tom Dumoulin?
Yeah, already people saying this is a Tom Dumoulin sort of parcours. But I think, again, we do this every year. Who's it going to suit? Well, it's going to suit the sorts of riders who can win the Tour de France.
It's going to suit the rider who's in the best form.
That is exactly it. It's going to suit the rider that copes with everything that the Tour throws at them in the best way. And that comes down to all the different factors, you know, weather, crashes, form, how their team performing, and how the race is raced. And I go back to the previous point, that there isn't anything that can put the race out of everybody's reach too early. You know, Mont Ventoux comes on stage 12. That could be the first point where we start to see some gaps open up. But then we've still got very difficult days in the Alps. And just because there isn't an Alpe d'Huez, there isn't an Issoire, there isn't, you know, the real huge set-piece stages, and just because there isn't the, you know, a succession of summit finishes, doesn't mean that those stages aren't difficult. They are very difficult. And they're going to reward riders who race. And I think the little tweaks to the King of the Mountains competition, which is awarding double points on the penultimate big mountains as well as the final one, the organisers are trying to sort of coax out more unpredictable racing, I guess.
Yeah, interesting that change to the King of the Mountains competition just after Chris Froome won it, who also won the race overall. The fact that he won both jerseys sort of devalued the King of the Mountains a little bit. So maybe they're wanting to go back to the King of the Mountains being a sort of secondary competition, but a competition that people are going to fight over. We should probably head to Daniel to get a bit more detail, the nitty-gritty of some of the climbs, some of the new climbs in particular. Before we do, just time bonuses as well are back. And there was a lot of confusion in the 2015 tour over whether the time bonuses were going to apply just on the first 10 stages or so, or throughout the race. They are going to apply, and they did apply in 2015. A lot of people didn't seem to realise that, but they're going to apply throughout the whole race, time bonuses, which is interesting. And having not had time bonuses for lots of years, to then apply them throughout the whole race is quite interesting. But I think it works.
Yeah, I mean, the reason for that confusion was because one set of documents were sent out shortly after the route announcement, and then when the full parkour and the detailed route was released, the document that went out to all the teams said that time bonuses would carry on throughout the whole race. But it's they're obviously seeking to engineer a close race, one that goes down to the final few stages in the Alps, and particularly with the penultimate stage, another very difficult one going over the Aravis, the Colombier, Col de la Ramaz, and the Juplan, which has been, in a way, the graveyard for a lot of Tour potential hopes in the past.
Okay, let's hear from Daniel with a bit more insight into the route and the climbs in particular. Daniel, over to you.
Listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney, and Daniel Freeb.
So, Daniel, has the tour route reached you over there in Germany? Are they interested in the Tour de France these days?
They certainly are, not least because it's looking very likely that next year's tour is going to start in Germany. Four towns are candidates for that at the moment, if I can remember correctly. It's Dusseldorf, Munster, Mannheim, and the area of, well, Saarland. Saarbrücken would probably be the hub of everything. But Dusseldorf looks like the favourite at the moment. So, yeah, we could all be coming to Germany in 2017 for the start of the tour. But this year's race will start in Mont-Saint-Michel, as we know. To me, it looks very mountainous again. It looks incredibly, almost excessively telegenic. It looks to me as though television is dictating more and more the way the tour route is designed. I'm thinking particularly of the final week. And this is not to be sniffed at or not really to be complained about from our point of view, because there are going to be some fantastic and very attractive looking stages. The stage to Coulars going over the Grand Colombier. They're going to go over, going up the, well, now almost famous hairpins of the Grand Colombier a second time on that stage, presumably because it's going to look so good on TV. The reservoir at Émosson in Switzerland will also look fantastic on TV. And then, of course, we've got the stage finishing sort of in the shadow of Mont Blanc, which is a familiar finish from one of the most prestigious amateur races in the world, the Giro della Val d'Aosta, but not too familiar from the Tour de France. I don't think the Tour de France has ever finished there.
So I've kind of fallen for the trap, really, of thinking that because there's a bit of a dearth of really famous climbs, particularly in the Alps, and the four summit finishes, Mont Ventoux aside, and I suppose Arcalis in Andorra, you know, famously used. Jan Ullrich won there, didn't he, in 1997. But it's not a sort of five-star famous greatest hits of the tour mountain route, is it really?
No, it's not. There are some unfamiliar names on there, not just the summit finishes, but some of the climbs that come in the middle of stages, and also going over climbs that we know quite well in unfamiliar directions, or for example, the Hawkett Dans Saison in the Pyrenees, which is quite well known now in the Tour de France. We're going up that a different way this time. But yeah, you are right. No Alpe d'Huez, obviously, no Galibier. But I think, generally speaking, it's a route that is quite similar to this year's, in the sense that there's a lot of drama packed into the final the final week. And as you will certainly remember, as listeners will also probably remember, I droned on continuously about this pendulum effect of that Nairo Quintana was going to come more and more into the race as the weeks went on and as the tour went on, just because he is a real diesel and he doesn't necessarily get any slower, unlike the other climbers in the race. And I think that will be the same this year. I hope, and I think we should make a pact now not to throw our arms up in the air and say, oh, the bloody race is over, when Chris Froome annihilates everyone at Arcalis in the Pyrenees. And that will kind of be the narrative that I expect if the race follows a similar pattern to this year. Certainly that will be where the explosive attacks happen in the Pyrenees, and then it'll be more of a war of attrition when we get to the back end of the Alps.
What do you make of the two time trials? And not the one to Megève is not an out and out mountain time trial, is it? But difficult enough.
I tend to ignore the time trials, to be honest. I mean, what's the point? I mean, it's another rest day, isn't it? I mean, they might as well just give a minute back to Froome and then carry on in the mountains. I mean, you know, we talk about innovation a lot, and there are innovative elements of this Tour de France. I mean, for one thing, it's going the same direction around France that it did this year, which is very unusual. So two anti-clockwise races in a row. But when we think about innovation, really, it's we shuffle around with the same formula all the time. And, you know, there might be more time trials, fewer time trials, but, you know, there are always time trials, and the mountain stages are broadly similar, broadly the same length. But, you know, I was thinking about this the other day, and actually talking to a former professional, Raphael Schrader, German professional. I was talking to him for the book I'm working on, and we were talking about how perhaps it's time to experiment with something really unusual. For instance, a 40-kilometre mountain stage, you know, rather than a 40-kilometre time trial, something like the stage where Where Bjarne Riis really lit up the 1996 Tour de France, and that at Sestriere, and that was a shortened stage that should have been much longer, but it was actually incredibly dramatic. And you know, I talked there about how telegenic this year's Tour de France is, but there's so much debate about how to make cycling more palatable, more marketable, and perhaps it's time to think about whether the audience wouldn't rather watch something that lasts an hour but is very, very exciting. Rather than something that lasts 5 or 6 hours in the mountains, and you know, something that we're very used to, but where if you're very objective about it, isn't always that interesting. And certainly a time trial, in my view, is not terribly interesting.
Well, it's almost as if you've been listening to the podcast while you've been in Berlin, oh, really? Daniel, because the other, which you clearly haven't, no. A couple of weeks ago, I was bemoaning the dearth of creativity from race organisers, not necessarily the grand tours, but certainly the tour of Abu Dhabi that we've just seen, you know, just basically road stages conforming to the same sort of format. I couldn't agree with you more. That stage in 96 was shortened because of the snow, and basically, it was 39 kilometres, wasn't it? And it was just all-out war. Obviously, that was an era of high EPO use as well, but nevertheless, it was a dramatic day, and shortening the stage just heightened the drama rather than lessened it.
Yeah, and let's be honest, why were professional cycling races around about 200 kilometres or in the past 300 kilometres? Originally, it was because it was considered a remarkable, incredible feat of endurance, and only within the capabilities of a few people to actually ride that distance on a bike. That's no longer the case. I mean, you know, I hear that you, Richard, and Rob have been training very hard. I'm sure you could even ride 200 kilometres these days. So that is no longer the unique selling point of professional cycling as a sport. That is no longer extraordinary. So what is extraordinary? It is the speed that they can ride at, whether it's 200 kilometres or whether it's 30 kilometres. I know, you know, endurance also comes into it, and recovery, and it's amazing that they can ride for every day for 3 weeks and ride up these mountains. But really, you know, we hear so much about making the sport more entertaining, yet we sometimes, I think, ignore the obvious. And we don't have to have gimmicks. We don't have to have mountain team time trials, or you know, downhill, upside down, roller coaster time trials, or anything like that. Just maybe think a bit more simply, and also look at the evidence. Look at the empirical evidence of the last few years, and where has the most drama taken place? Where have the most exciting stages taken place? And it's generally been the 100 kilometer, 110 kilometer mountain stages, which have been rare. But when we've had them, they've almost invariably been fantastic.
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Join us on Twitter and Facebook. Just search online for the Cycling Podcast.
Great to hear there from Daniel, wasn't it, Lionel? Looking forward to him coming back in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, he's coming back. You've revealed you're going off for a couple of weeks. You know, when are we going to get everyone back together?
I would say mid-November, Lionel. In fact, I can tell you exactly when we're all going to be back together. We're going to be back together on Sunday the 15th of October at the London Sports Writing Festival from 2 o'clock till 3 o'clock. The three of us will be offering our alternative review of the year and giving out some awards. Well, not really giving out some awards, just talking about some theoretical awards that we've made up. And so we'll be doing that. It'll be hopefully slightly humorous, but we'll have to work on that a little bit. We'll have to come up with some gags. But no, it's a live event. Tickets available at the London Sports Writing Festival website. It's at Lord's in London, the home of cricket. So please do come along. I think tickets are selling well for that, so grab your ticket while you can and come and be part of the audience at the Cycling Podcast Live at Lord's on the 15th of October. Lionel,
November, 15th of November.
November, apologies. So before we head into the velodrome and watch some six-day racing, Lionel, there was some seasons kind of drawing to a close, but the European Track Championships were on last weekend. I know Chris Hoy is in the velodrome today, hoping to have a chat to him about how the British team got on. But any standouts for you? What are the headlines?
Well, the headlines on the men's side were that Great Britain won the team pursuit. Elia Viviani won the Omnium in very impressive style. And that Omnium competition, we were talking about this before we began recording, that could be shaping up to be one of the standout events of the Rio Olympics next year.
Well, we've got Viviani in sparkling form. He's really stepped up this year. And you know, looked almost unbeatable there. Brian Cockard will be riding the Omnium in Rio, we think, as well. And Mark Cavendish, of course, has got his eye on that. Now, it's an interesting scenario that crossed my mind. Viviani, of course, rides for the British team, Team Sky, set to be a real threat to Mark Cavendish, another British rider. The relationship between Team Sky and British Cycling isn't quite what it was, but there's still a relationship there. And you wonder if there'd be a temptation to maybe do Mark Cavendish a favour in the Omnium in Rio by making Viviani ride both the Giro and the Tour. They could really ruin his chance, because I think he'll fancy that. I imagine that he'll ride the Giro and then miss the Tour as he did this year. But, you know, if they wanted to be a bit sneaky about it, they could do that. I don't think they will, but they could.
What, send him to every race from the Tour Down Under to the Tour de France? And
on his knees.
On his knees before Rio, yeah. No, I can't see that happening. I don't think they would. I don't think that would be the best way to keep one of their top riders, as he's becoming, happy. Also at the European Track Championships, which are in Switzerland, on the in the women's competition, a great few days for Laura Trott and Katie Archibald, who ended with three gold medals apiece. They were both in the team pursuit squad. Laura Trott won the Omnium and the scratch race, and Katie Archibald won the individual pursuit and the elimination race. Once again, the British women's team, you know, they never really seem to miss a beat. The level of competition at the Euros is not the same as at the World Championships, but they are a good half step ahead of everybody else at the moment.
Laura Trott is a machine. She's so consistent and always seems to have that hunger for racing. It's quite remarkable. And Katie Archibald has really come on a lot the last couple of years. It's a shame that there isn't an individual pursuit in Rio, because she would be perhaps a favourite for that. There'd be a very good men's individual pursuit as well, were such a thing to still be on the programme. Lionel, you can probably hear a bike being wheeled past us there. That's maybe a sign that we should go into the velodrome. Shall we head in?
Yeah, the 6 days probably just about to start. Night three, let's go and see what it's all about, see how it compares to some of the European events.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast, brought to you by Trainer Road, cycling's most effective training tool. Pair your power meter with over 800 workouts and 80 training plans to make you a faster cyclist. Visit trainerroad.com/SPC to try Trainer Road risk-free for 30 days.
So Lionel, we've walked into the track centre here, and the first person we bumped into is Gary Beckett, Swanier with Cannondale Garmin. Hello, Gary.
Hello, how are you?
Very well, yeah. You're Swanier with Cannondale Garmin, but you're here working with two young British lads.
Yeah, I'm flying the flag for the team here a little bit. You know,
you're wearing a non-regulation T-shirt.
The sponsor's happy, we're over here. And I've got O'Shea, who is budget forklifts, isn't he? Adam Blythe is Orica Greenedge, but he's moving to Tinkoff. And then the two Academy boys, Jermaine Burton and Mark Stewart.
So, yeah, in the summer, you're Swanier with Cannondale Garmin, but you do a lot of work at the 6 days in the winter. You've been working the 6 day circuit for many years. Just can you talk us through the setup here? You've got the cabins, and I just put my hand on something very hot here. What's that?
This is our little tumble dryer. You can't get these anymore. I think they've probably got the last one in Europe. Seriously. Most of the old established Swanyers have all got these. And what will happen is this stadium is quite warm, so it's not too much of an issue for the riders. But as soon as they come down off the track, obviously they're sweating like crazy. Sit them in there, I strip them off, towel them down, and then their vests and jerseys go into here, tumble dry them, ready for the next race. So they've got three jerseys, three under vests, so they're constantly rotating the jerseys to stay dry.
So you worked at all the big 6 day races. How does this one, this a new addition on the calendar this winter, how does this one compare with the traditional sixes in Europe?
Well, so far, you know, I mean, obviously a first event anywhere, there's a few little teething problems, but it's running along fairly smoothly. It's quite an early program, you know, by this By that I mean in Europe it probably won't be starting until 8 o'clock and it'll run until 1, 2 o'clock in the morning. Here they've got to be started by 6:30, which I would imagine is a bit of a struggle for people to get here from work in time, and you've got to be finished by, I think it's 10:45 here, to catch the infrastructure of London Transport, basically.
What for you makes a six-day race special? What gives it its unique character?
My guy's winning because then I get the champagne. it's non-stop. It's fast, furious. You know, there's for instance, I've got four riders here working alone. I wouldn't take any more than four because I couldn't do the job properly. They'd be chopping and changing off the track into the camp, just too much for one guy. So you have to have a runner helping you in that situation. But it is a continuously non-stop show, in theory.
What I'm impressed by is that the tradition of the cabins has been maintained here. If you've not been to a six-day before, the riders' changing rooms, effectively, they're like little Swiss cabins, aren't they? Wood-panelled. That's their only private bit of space all evening, isn't it?
It is. You know, in this velodrome, because it's more modern, the facilities, the toilets are not too far away. So, like, on these cabins, you've got the curtains to pull across, because in the corner there, am I allowed to say piss? There should be a piss bucket. But, and that's one of the soigneur's jobs. When you start to learn to be a six-day soigneur, first thing they'll teach you, can you carry the piss bucket without spilling it, or you're not worried about carrying it, because the riders will pull the curtain, piss there. But here they can just wander down to the toilet. Yeah, and if they're putting grease on their chamois or something, you need a bit of privacy there. But you might get a joker in your cabin, or you'll be having a piss there, and then all of a sudden pull the curtains wide open and pissing in front of the crowd. Rob Hales being one of those jokers.
Oh, speak of the devil, here is Rob Hales.
Speak of the devil.
Rob, is this true?
I was just saying about sometimes when you're having a piss in the piss bucket and someone might pull the curtain back on you.
Ah, Bradley only did it to me several times.
Rob, did you work with Gary on the six-day circuit at all?
I'm afraid we did, yes. Yeah, we go back an awful long way.
I think 6 days especially, the role of the soigneur is particularly important, it seems, and going way back, the soigneur seems to really perform a really valuable role. I'm not saying they don't in road racing as well, but it's, as you say, it's full on, it's non-stop at 6 days, isn't it?
I think a six-day soigneur is a bit more of a special breed of soigneur. It's old school. It's really, you learn how to be a basic soigneur in the 6 day. When I first came in, I thought I knew quite a bit what to do, and I worked with one of the old guys, Etienne Illigans, who's been a soigneur for, I think, 55 years now. And then I learned that I wasn't a six-day soigneur, and you learn the Belgian way, which is not always correct, but it's Belgian, and they think it's correct.
When was your first one, then?
2000, I think. Wigo and Newton. Yeah, you weren't first. I think you came with me in second year.
And the races are sort of part race, part exhibition. But has that maybe changed over the years, Rob? Is it more the racing is legitimate?
It's full on. It really is. And the thing that has always been is the racing is always hard. You get to the last night and there will be discussions amongst the top teams. And there'll be stamping of the fists on the table at lunchtime. But when you're in there, you know, if they don't want you to win, there's no way you're going to win. So they're not staged in as such, and it's not, oh, they're really easy, you just roll round, and if you take three laps, it's because they've been given to you. They are racing full on, and some of the gears that the riders are on here, obviously it's a bigger track, but, you know, they're riding on like 97, 98 inch gear. We were riding on 88, 89. 90, so they are going a lot quicker than we used to. How long they can keep that going for in this six, I don't know. But just going back to kind of the role of the soigneur at the 6 day compared to a road race, once the guys have started the race and they've gone to the start line, that's it, you don't see them for the rest of the day. In the six, they are up, down, up, down. And if you didn't have a soigneur, if you didn't have your own mechanic and you're doing it all yourself, you'd really struggle, you really would.
Well, we better let you keep an eye on the racing here then, Gary. We feel like we've distracted you a little bit here.
About what? What are you distracted?
There's a race going on as we're speaking. I don't know.
He's easily distracted.
I don't know if you noticed.
I wonder what they were doing.
Right, we'll let you get on. Thanks very much, Gary. Good luck. Have a good one.
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Download old episodes absolutely free at thecyclingpodcast.com.
Lionel, look who we've bumped into. Sir Chris Hoy. Hello, Chris.
What are the chances, Richard? What are the chances?
Amazing. Chris, you're here for the London 6 Day. You've got a bit of experience of 6 days in your own career, if you can remember that far back.
You've got some experience of 6 days, Richard. Rotterdam.
I came and watched you in Rotterdam. Yeah, you were taking part in the sprinters races there. Tao Bos was the local favourite. I think he won that, actually.
Well, if you remember, Richard, it was the night before. We'd had a few beers, and I think that possibly affected the end result, but...
You had a flying over.
The thing was, I actually was ill that week, and because we had a couple of beers 2 nights before, people assumed that I was just had some horrendous hangover, and it was ended up being like some proper fever flu that was off the bike for about 10 days, and it was Olympic year as well. So
it was 2008. It was the start of 2008. So just for Beijing Olympics, you did all right there.
Yeah, well, it was actually, like, joking apart, it was just when I started to really get to grips with the sprint. And Tao was the man at that point. He was world champion, the favourite for the gold medal in Beijing. And, you know, it was just that point that we really started, or I started to make progression and you know, turn things around.
But the sprinters races here as well, Chris, and there's always a suspicion, especially here, actually, there's been a lot of showmanship. And we were speaking about this in connection with the Madison racing earlier on as well, but six-day racing do seem to be sort of part exhibition, part serious competition. What is the balance like? How serious is the racing here?
Well, the point is that there's nothing riding on it in terms of medals or championships. Or I think the fear of making a mistake or losing isn't as great as a proper championship. So you can actually go out there, try different tactics. You can race. It's still full-on racing, but there's not so much on the line. So the riders tend to be more relaxed. They tend to enjoy themselves more. And if you look at the time trial, 200-meter time trial results from the 6 days, they're still comparable to World Cups. They're rapid times, so they're not hanging around. They're not just soft-pedaling. It is proper racing, but the riders are willing to lose a race just to try new tactics or kind of have a bit of showmanship. And you'll see track stands that are allowed for longer than the 10 seconds maximum. You'll see just some of the rules bent a little bit in terms of throwing hooks and certain moves that you wouldn't do because you'd know you'd get relegated in a World Cup or a World Champs. But it is for the crowd. It is showmanship, but it is still full-on racing.
Now, Chris, it was European Championships last week. Not an event that you had a great record in. I don't want to remind you of some
of you.
Well,
you already have. Thanks, Richard. I won one gold medal in the Europeans. That was 1999. And then the last two, one was like... hey, mate, how you doing? One was an embarrassing exit in the first round.
If you type into YouTube, maybe Chris Hoy.
No, you don't have to.
Chris Hoy, European Championship.
I don't think you have to. You know, I think we can leave it there, Richard. But
We'll put a link somewhere with the podcast. It's entertaining.
About you, Richard.
It's entertaining.
If you want me to, I can.
I was going to talk about the European Championships last week. The British team, good, strong performance overall. Well, I am, actually. What's your assessment of them at this particular point?
I think you've got to look at it in different segments and different groups. Female endurance, I think, absolutely on the money, exactly where they would want to be, maybe even ahead of where they would expect to be. Bodes really well for the next 9-10 months. Men's endurance, I would say the same. You know, there's always... You know, the Aussies are their sort of nemesis team, or not really nemesis because they've beaten them at every games, but they're the biggest challengers, the Kiwis as well. But they've sent a message out there with a 355, and they've done a 354, I think, at Derby a few months ago too. Bradley and the team, these guys that, you know, Ed was missing with an injury. They've got such a strong squad, and to set out, you know, set their stall out this early with a fantastic time, brilliant. Men's sprint, women's sprint, not as good, you know, and I think that despite some good performances that were, you know, maybe not highlighted by the fact they didn't win medals, you know, it's still not good enough. It's not what they would want, where they would want to be, but it's not for lack of trying. You know, they are, I know the guys, obviously, I know the coaches, and I know what's going on behind the scenes in terms of the work they're doing. They are doing everything they possibly can, but it's not quite coming together right now. But it didn't come together for us, as you mentioned, at the Europeans pre-London, even pre-Beijing. So it's not to say they can't do it when it really counts. But
Jason Kenny has an amazing record of not really doing an awful lot, in between Olympic Games and then bringing his A game to the Olympics.
Which is what you want. And people don't remember, apart from you, people don't remember what happens at European Championships if you win the Olympics. You want to, every race you enter, you want to win. You always want to be a champion. You always want to win races. But if you're going to sacrifice anything, it's the time in between the Olympics to step on that podium when it really counts.
Right. Well, Chris, we'll let you get back to your VIP hospitality. But just finally, you're a petrolhead now. Your motor racing career is going from strength to strength. Tell us what your plans are next year.
I'm working tonight, Richard. I don't know. You're the one that's in the hospitality. He's, you know, making out as if.
Piggybacking on people that we know. Tell us about you've had a success recently, and next year is a big year for you.
Yeah, well, this season's been a big step up. I raced in the European Le Mans Series, and that's endurance racing where you're racing at the moment. It's 4-hour races, five times throughout the season. We won three of those races, third in the other one, and then the last one we didn't actually finish. The car broke down, but we won the championship. So I'm a European champion. I'm a European champion now, Richard, in motorsport. There you go. Put that
finally
in your pipe and smoke it. There we go.
Finally.
I forgot, I'm a European champion, a current European champion. So, it's been a fantastic season. I'm racing with Charlie Robertson, who's a young, very promising Scottish driver, racing with the Nissan Ginetta team, LMP3 category. But next season, I'll be making, hopefully, a big step up to do the 24 Hours of Le Mans. And that's, it's not even a childhood dream. I never thought it would be possible, so I didn't even dream about it. But obviously followed it as a kid, watched it on the telly, took a great interest, but never thought I'd ever get the chance to actually be there myself.
Well, we can't cover it because we're a cycling podcast, but we'll be watching from afar with great interest. That's in June, isn't it?
It is in June. Well, there's a 24 Hours of Le Mans bike race as well. You could come down for that. You could probably do that.
We could do that.
The dream team.
We've got lots of reserves. We could do that, couldn't we, Lionel?
Yep. Yeah,
that's a definite yes.
We're committed. Okay, Chris, thanks very much. Back to your champagne and caviar. Thanks very much.
Prawn sandwiches. Yeah, cheers. Thanks.
Cheers.
Take care.
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast in association with British Eurosport.
Well, Lionel, we've just come out of the London 6 Day. Enjoyable evenings racing?
I think so, for the crowd who are here. It's a strange one, isn't it? I can't quite get a handle on it. It doesn't feel like a 6 Day to me, but then that's because my experience of a 6 Day is so tightly wrapped up in the Ghent 6, which has a completely different atmosphere, a completely different origin. It feels a little bit corporate.
And actually the European 6 Days, the crowd don't appear to be paying much attention to the racing. They're there to, it's a social event, they're there to drink beer and eat hot dogs and have a good time, but that somehow that actually is what gives those races their unique character.
It does, but other than Ghent and perhaps one or two others, over the last 15 years, the 6 Day circuit has shrunk. Those events haven't survived. I think in the UK, we've seen how Revolution has kind of, with a tighter one-night-only program and then the last year or so extending to different venues and, you know, having experimenting with the formats, they've come up with a real winning formula. And I think seeing this here, I wonder whether the 6 Day format of racing is quite as accessible as it needs to be to get the whole crowd on side and understanding what's going on. It's quite a complicated format. Watching Madison's and then there's some sprint races and then there's sort of two-man 500-meter time trials. And obviously, yes, it all adds up towards the overall standings. But I think it's given me a sort of fresh perspective on what Revolution has brought to track racing, certainly in this country. I wouldn't necessarily swap it for the Ghent 6 either, because the Ghent 6, as I say, has that character all of its own. It's a completely different event. It's difficult as well because this venue I associate with championship racing. It's the Olympic venue. We've been here for World Cups. The World Championships will be here next year. It hasn't quite captured the party atmosphere of the...
Well, we were here last for the Bradley Wiggins Hour Record. A very febrile atmosphere in there. That was extraordinary. It showed you what this place can be like. And I've been here, obviously. I was here for the Olympic Games in 2012 as well. You know, astonishing atmosphere in there for that. And there wasn't a huge crowd tonight. It was decent. It was decent, but it wasn't huge. And I think you're absolutely right that the racing isn't that accessible. And if you're new to track cycling, I don't think you'd necessarily really know what was going on. At the same time, it did feel quite a corporate event, which I think cycling in the UK does seem to be more than in Europe. You know, there was a lot of corporate hospitality going on in the track centre, and it felt a bit more corporate.
Yeah, definitely. And I think this is a point Daniel's made about the difference between Europe and the UK. Europe, cycling is very much the working man's sport. And sorry to keep going on about the Ghent 6, but the middle of the track is where that's the cheapest ticket for the night. You stand up, you stand in the middle, it's crammed in like sardines, particularly towards the weekend. The bars are busy. And if you want to get outside of that kind of melee, you need to pay a little bit extra to get a seat. Whereas here, it's the other way around. The ordinary spectators are in the seats, and the track centre, which is probably the most more exciting place to be, is reserved for, you know, there's a kind of a bar area, and there's canapes and, you know, sponsorship kind of things going on. But let's be fair, it's Tuesday night. I think I'm regretting not coming on either Sunday night or one of the nights closer to the weekend, but unfortunately not able to have done that. I think as a first event, you know, Sir Chris Hoy is absolutely right. The potential for it is massive, and they'll no doubt tweak some of the things next year.
I think also, bearing in mind that none of the real British stars are competing, which Revolution always has, you know, some Olympic gold medalists and so on, which does help sell tickets. They've done very well to sell as many tickets as they have, considering that, you know, it's a decent field with some well-known names, but none of the sort of British stars taking part. So, bearing all that in mind, good effort. Anyway, we'll wrap up this week's podcast of two halves, really, with Tour de France 2016 route, look ahead to. And
it's an incredible juxtaposition, isn't it, of the Tour de France route and six-day cycling. It's like the meeting of two opposite ends of the cycling spectrum.
It is, Lionel, yes. Well, that's this podcast is a broad church, and we'll be back next week with a more standard, regular-type episode. Actually, no, we're planning something a bit different next week as well, but you'll have to tune in next week for that.
Are we?
Yeah. One word. Lance.
Oh, yes, of course, yes. Oh, I'm looking forward to that, yeah.
Okay, well, anyway, that's enough on that note. Let's bid adieu to the Lee Valley Velo Park, and we'll be back next week. Thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
You've been listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.